Hi, I'm Tara Lee, and welcome to Starbeing, your cosmic journey to self-discovery, higher consciousness, and spiritual exploration. This podcast serves as a guiding light, illuminating the path to wisdom, healing, and conscious living. Let Starbeing ignite your inner light as we transcend limitations and tap into the universal consciousness that unites and empowers all of us. Welcome to episode 14, Tantra, Mantra, and Yantra with Vinita Rishinka. I am honored to introduce Vinita. She is a spiritual healer, writer, speaker, and wellness expert dedicated to uplifting others on their spiritual journeys. As the founding director of Sri Chakra Yantra Foundation, she brings people together to improve well-being, cultivate spiritual knowledge, and expand consciousness. Her deep understanding of Tantra and Sri Vidya offers invaluable guidance to those seeking a deeper connection to their spiritual path. Vinita's teachings have expanded my own thinking. Her humility and generosity are evident in every interaction, and I am so grateful to share her wisdom with you. I hope that you enjoy this episode. We really explain what Tantra is and how it is not what it has been portrayed in our modern time. And we also go into Yantra and the importance and the power of it, mantras as a mind tool. And we really go into some deep spiritual and esoteric philosophies. So please enjoy. If you are loving Starbeing, please leave a rating and a review. And if you have any aha moments or takeaways from this episode, please share with myself and Vinita and enjoy. I am very excited to welcome Vinita Rishinka to the Starbeing podcast. Before we begin, Vinita is going to give us a prayer as an abundant blessing.
Shuklam Varadaram Vishnum Shashivarnam Chaturbhujam Prasannavadanam Dhyayet Sarva Vigno Pashante Guru Brahma Guru Vishnu Guru Devo Maheshwaraha Guru Sakshat Parabrahma Tasmay Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Matre Namaha.
Thank you so much.
Namaste, Tara.
Namaste. I have been really looking forward to connecting with you. I usually listen to my podcasts on audio, but for some reason, I happen to be on YouTube and I saw you and I immediately needed to click on. And as soon as I heard you speak, I was just entranced by what you were saying. And so I wanted to begin there in that way that this knowledge comes into our life. The teacher appears when the student is ready. And I feel like the path that I've been on for the last couple of months has really been deeply exploring what it is to be the divine feminine, also exploring more of Shiva. I've been actually doing mantra of Shiva recently. And the more that I've delved into your work, it's made more sense why I've come across your teachings now. And so I wanted to begin there on how that happens. And I've heard, because I've gone in depth in your work, you've said that these types of teachings appear when they sort of attract to you rather than you find them, they find you. So I'd love to know your experience with that as well and how you've come to this path.
I was born and brought up in a very rationalistic family, if I may say so. there was really no interest in religion or spirituality. So it came as a bit of a surprise to me that I was always drawn towards everything that was esoteric, and particularly in respect to Hinduism and Sanatana, as we call it today. And I was very fortunate because my profession also supported me. I was into Ayurveda and yoga, and I was lucky enough to work with individuals who were really top of the game in the field of all these esoteric sciences, as it were. And I got initiated into transcendental meditation in the year 2003. And I would mark that as my first step in my spiritual path. Although there was a break of about 17 or 18 years before I actually started a regular practice, because one gets busy with raising the family and building one's career and all of that. And it was in 2018 when it was a rather unfortunate incident which led me into going into the depths of spirituality. But like I always say, everything that happens, good, bad, or ugly, is only there to help us move further on the path. And it's all in the divine plan. And 5 years hence, books, just completing my sixth book. And sometimes it just feels like the divine is watching over me and telling me what to do at every step. And today here I am speaking with you to an international audience about Tantra and about Shiva and Shakti. And it's just the universe conspiring to bring us all together.
Yes, I love that. And that's what it feels like. It feels like we have potentially had previous conversations in other lifetimes. And that's why we're speaking here today. I would love to speak to you about the definition of Tantra. This is something that has always interested me, but I've really, through your work, through your books, I have a complete different definition of what it is in the mainstream. So I was wondering if you could explain what Tantra is, what the Tantra practice consists of, and that methodology.
At the most basic level, Tantra is merely a methodology. It is just the framework that guides us to three things. One is transformation, empowerment, and eventually a heightened level of consciousness. So for me, even though it's a very ancient mystical tradition, which was born in India, today it is a universal language which can help us traverse the path and find spiritual solace on the way. Mm. What are the essential components of Tantra? I would put it down to three things. One is the philosophy of non-dualism, which is Advaita. The practice of mantra coupled with some ritualistic use of the yantra, which is the geometric, the sacred geometry, the drawings associated with the mandalas, and with Hinduism and in Tibetan religions, we see this a bit. And then the kundalinis and the chakra. So these are the three essential aspects that we will need to touch upon when we talk about Tantra. Now, for an actual definition of the word Tantra, we can break the word up into tan, which means to weave or to, you know, kind of expand, and tra, which comes from the word trayati, which means to liberate. So it is essentially one of expansion and eventually leading to liberation. Mm.
Yes, I love that. And so in the modern definition of Tantra that has been portrayed, it has been Yeah, more around sexuality, and I had a huge focus on that. Where do you think that, I don't know if this is correct terminology of saying distortion of this happened? Is it because like all these ancient knowledge that it's so powerful that it needs to be distorted in some way? I'm just interested to know why you think it had that distortion here.
I would liken it to what happened with yoga. Yoga in the traditional Sanatana aspect is more of a preparation for what is to come in terms of meditation and in terms of samadhi, which is the ultimate dissolution with the divine consciousness. But yoga, particularly in the recent past, has come to only mean the exercise aspect of it, only the aspect which covers the asanas, whereas yoga actually has 8 limbs, which include meditation and breath control and withdrawal, all of those things, right? So in a way, this is exactly what has happened with Tantra. Whatever is the lowest lying fruit has been picked, and then that has been disseminated as being Tantra. While there is no denying that sexuality is a part of Tantra, it's not the most important part. It is not even among the 10 most important things in Tantra. But then that is something that everyone can understand, everyone is interested in. So I think it has come to define Tantra, unfortunately, because it narrows the scope of what a wonderful philosophy Tantra actually is.
Yes, thank you so much for diving into that. And that is what I have loved in exploring Tantra through your lens and going deeper in the definition is this whole aspect of, I think in the core of spirituality, there is this philosophy that life is suffering and it feels very heavy. And we can all look in our life and, you know, that can be said to be true. But what I found so liberating and so refreshing is this is almost like I've been looking for this teaching that it can have this pleasure aspect, that we can achieve liberation through pleasure rather than suffering. And this was enlightening to me because I was like, oh, there's a different way. And this is really what your work has opened up to me. So I was wondering if you could dive a little bit deeper into that aspect of Tantra as having that same goal of self-realization and self-liberation through pleasure and not necessarily needing to renounce our life or renounce our material possessions, and having that duality and holding it all.
We have to understand this in the context of how Tantra differs a little bit from the Vedic tradition. The Vedic tradition is all about renunciation. It's about giving up your worldly desires and then moving into a space where it's more about just practice and focusing entirely on the spiritual path. Now, Tantra actually came as a rebellion. And the entire premise, which differs largely from most Eastern religions and philosophies, is that you can have both bhoga, which is the pleasures of living, which include things like leading a pleasurable life in terms of eating good food, enjoying all the experiences that come your way, having a good family relationship, all of that. And then eventually aspiring towards moksha, which is liberation. In Tantra, the interesting part is that liberation comes from realizing the non-duality of our existence. So that is why it is okay in Tantra to find all the pleasures, to enjoy all the pleasures, because eventually there is really no difference between the material world and the spiritual world because of the underlying philosophy of non-duality.
Mm. I love that. Could you explain the concept of non-duality?
Non-duality is rather counterintuitive to all of us because we always see everything as a subject and an object, right? That's the way our mind functions and that's how we have been brought up to think. Now, here's a philosophy which challenges that entire premise. And I will give you two examples just to simplify the philosophy of Advaita, which is non-duality. The first example, when we look at the ocean and we see the waves, we always think of the waves as a part of the ocean. We never think of each wave as a separate entity. Would you agree with me there?
Yes.
But when we start looking at the wave as disparate from the ocean, is when the duality sets in.
Mm.
Now, to take you to the second example, after which I will qualify the examples, we have the sun, and we can imagine about 1,000 buckets of water in which the sun is reflecting. Each reflection cannot believe that it has an individual identity, because when we look further, we realize that it is merely a reflection of the one sun. In the same way, every individual soul, what we call jiva, is merely a reflection of Paramatma, which is the divine consciousness. So each individual consciousness is merely a reflection of the divine. And this is the entire premise of Advaita or non-duality.
Is it clear?
Or yes. You want me to...
Yes, no, thank you for explaining that. I love that, that we're all part of that, I guess, that unity consciousness and coming back to that. When you talk about Tantra, you also have mentioned Yantra and in your book, Mantra. Could you go into both of these aspects of Tantra a little bit more in regards to that methodology?
Surely. Now, yantra has a greater meaning because let's understand it like this. Words often are not sufficient. They are not capable of delivering the message of deep spiritual concepts. This is where symbols come in. And you will see this in all religions across the globe. Symbolism plays a great role in explaining philosophical concepts. So in Hinduism and in Buddhism to a large extent, we have the mandalas, which utilize geometric shapes and patterns to convey certain messages. Now the yantras are essentially coming out of this philosophy of sacred geometry. So the main yantra, which is worshipped in the tantric practice of the tradition that I follow, which is Sri Vidya, is called the Sri Yantra, which is considered to be the king of all yantras because every other yantra can be extracted from it. So it's like the master from where you can draw whichever yantra you want. So it's like the blueprint. And the reason why sacred geometry is so important and so useful is because it has something to do with neuroplasticity. It works with the brain, and the circuitry in the brain is actually changing every time you're looking at some sacred geometry. Because sacred geometry exists in nature itself. It's not something that we created.
Mm.
It is a creation of the intelligence of the universe itself. So we are merely reflecting upon it and we are taking examples of it to suit our purpose. And then we come to mantras. Mantras are sounds, syllables, which in Sanskrit are not really different from the vibrations. So each sound creates a certain vibration. So we utilize the magic and the power of these vibrations to bring about whatever it is that needs to be changed. If we need to look at achieving a heightened consciousness, then we kind of tune in to that mantra, which gives us a vibration of a higher consciousness. If we are looking at seeking material abundance, then there is a mantra for that. So there are various mantras. And when we are talking of mantras, it's important to understand that mantras are of two kinds. At the very basic level, you have what are called the Bija mantras, which are like the seed mantras. I could give you the example of Aim, Shreem, Hreem, Kleem. These are all tantric Bija mantras, which mean that they are not just the sound that you hear, but there is a certain strong vibration associated with each of these sounds. And then you have the Siddha mantras, which are more possibly longer and probably which have been handed down and which are man-made to that extent, in the sense that they were probably written down and assimilated.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the mantras, because in my experience, these have been really powerful in allowing me to choose better thoughts is the way that I've been able to use the mantra. But sometimes lately I have been focusing more on saying the mantras internally rather than externally. I was wondering what your take on that is, and if you think that they're more powerful chanted externally or just said inwardly.
Again, it depends on the kind of mantra that you are chanting. In our tradition, we have very long, elaborate mantras, which are sometimes called stotras and stutis. They are meant to be chanted out aloud, preferably in a group setup, because that has a different kind of vibration. The frequency that it arouses is different. And then the bijas, which we were talking about, like Aim, Shreem, Kleem, they are better chanted mentally because then they give you control over your mind. That's the whole idea of it. So even though we are talking about vibrations, when we are thinking, that also creates a process of vibration. There is a frequency associated even with thought. So that's how mantras work at a level where they're not being articulated. Even if they are merely mentally being chanted, there is still something at play there because still neuroplasticity is at work. It's like the example I can give is if you have, you know, one of those old-fashioned record players and the player is stuck at a certain point, then that groove gets deeper and deeper and deeper. In the same way, when there's something going on in your mind, the grooves, the neural pathways are getting deeper. And that is helping you to become more conscious and probably attain a higher level of consciousness. And this is a repeated practice. This is not something that you do one time. Like most spiritual practices, it has to be continued in order for it to have an effect. It's you give it up for a while and then the brain goes back to its old pathways. So it's exactly the same with any spiritual practice, and particularly so with mantras.
Yes, I love that. Thank you for explaining that. When it comes to the Shri Vidya Yantra, the master yantra that you were explaining, do you Can you explain more about the potency of that, the shape of it? I've heard you speak about the way to look at it in a meditative state, but I was also curious to know if, and I'm sure you'll go into this when you explain how to look at this actual shape, how, if we look at it from completely from the right side to the left side, or yeah, I'd just love to know how it should be looked at.
The Sri Yantra can be approached in two ways. One is you start with the point which is at the center and move from there all the way outward to the square, which you see at the periphery of the yantra, or the other way, which is probably more practical and easier to do, is to move from out inwards and then focus on the one point, which is called the bindu. So this is a way of looking at it from either creativity or from a point of dissolution. So usually what we do is we suggest that you move outward in, because that's the way in which we kind of start to wear the blinkers in spirituality. It's like you start cutting out all the sensory impulses, all the sensory inputs, and then start withdrawing to a point where you come to a single focus. So this is exactly that same method, which works much better than going outward. Because if we have to look at life itself, there are two ways in which we can approach it. There is one in which the energy flow is outward and downward. So what do I mean by that? So let's assume we are talking about food. So the food that we consume is coming from external source, and then when you consume it, the energy is going downward, right? So you can apply this to any of the pleasurable things that you do. They're all outward and downward. Now in spirituality, when you do any spiritual practice, it's inward and upward. So what do I mean by that? When you're in a spiritual practice, you're looking inside. The inputs are coming from within you, and then the energy is moving in an upward direction, not in a downward direction. So that's when we come to the aspect about chakras, which I think you will be coming to in a little while. But just to make the difference between outward and downward and inward and upward movement of energy.
Thank you for clarifying that, because yes, when I was looking at the yantra, I wasn't sure with my eye if I should be focusing on, like you said, going from the outside inward, and then whether I should be looking from the right or left, or does that matter? It's just going around.
So how one does it is one starts with the outer periphery and then go in through the several layers. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at it from the left or the right. Yeah. Ideally, I would say start from the top and then move downwards. Mm-hmm. Because then it's a lot easier on the eye, and it's a far easier process of meditation. Mm. Because then you're not so focused on trying to get each layer right. It just naturally flows. So you go from the square to the first set of petals, and then the second set of petals to, you know, the first set of triangles, and so on and so forth until you arrive at the bindu.
Thank you. I would love to, like you mentioned, speak to you about the chakras and with the Kundalini energy as well, and fitting this into the methodology. I also have another question about the Kundalini. In what is it, and how do we awaken it? And also, how do we know when it's awoken? And also, thirdly, I've heard you mention how we're trying to bring the Kundalini energy at least to our heart. And this really resonated with me. So I'd love it if you could speak on those aspects.
Sure. Now, where does Kundalini fit in the entire universe of Tantra? Kundalini is the energy that really is lying dormant in all of us. It is, okay, let's start with an understanding of how yoga or in the entire Indian tradition, how we look at the body. This is the physical body that we're looking at, which is the gross body, which consists of the muscles and the blood and the bones and all of that. So around this, we have what is called the Sukshma Sharira, which is the energy body, right? So that's the subtle body. And beyond that, we have something called the Karana Sharira, which is the causal body, which is the reason why we are here, which carries through from various janmas, from various lifetimes, because we have to carry the memories of our previous lives. So how does that happen? That happens through the Karana Sharira, but that's going too esoteric. We'll stick with the Sukshma Sharira for now, which is the subtle body, which is the energy body. This energy body finds its base at the bottom of our spine, at the perineum. This is called the Mooladhara, where the Kundalini lies dormant. It is depicted as a coiled serpent, which is lying with its head down because it's dormant. And it is 3.5 times because it stands for past, present, future and all of that. And the half is to represent that, you know, the head is lying down. So it can't be done with just 3 coils. So the head downward is the other half of the Kundalini. And the entire idea in Tantra is to have this energy awakened, move through all the chakras, the six chakras, and come to the 7th chakra, which is the Sahasrara chakra, say about 2 inches above your head at, you know, the energy body level. And once that happens is when you will experience enlightenment, where you will understand that you're no different from the divine consciousness, and where the merging happens, the yuga happens, you know, the coming together, the union happens.
Mm.
And how does this energy rise? There is one energy meridian called the Sushumna Nadi, which lies along the backbone, the spine, which is called the Sushumna, and the energy rises through this nadi and traverses all the way from the Mooladhara to the Sahasrara chakra. Mm. So I can take you through the chakras if you so wish.
Yes, I would love that.
Okay. So we start at the base chakra, which is the Mooladhara. Mooladhara means the root chakra. And each of the chakras has certain emotions, feelings, all of that associated with it, just as we also associate color and the various elements. So the Mooladhara has to do with survival and grounding. And the color associated with it is red. And where is it located? At the perineum, at the base of the spine. And then we move to the Swadhisthana, which you can place just under your belly button. This is also what is called the sacral chakra, and it is responsible for creativity and sexuality. As in, it corresponds. So just to stop here for a moment, these chakras correspond to the various plexuses which exist in the physical body. So although we can't pinpoint and say this is exactly where a chakra is, you can take your attention to that area so that the energy flows to that particular part of your body. Mm-hmm. From the Swadhisthana, we move to the Manipura chakra, which is around your belly button. That Manipura is the chakra, is what is called the solar plexus chakra. And it has to do with your willpower, your ambition. And the element there is fire, because digestion is considered to be like a fire, which is utilizing the food that you consume and burning it for calories and, you know, to carry out all the bodily functions. And from there, we move into the upper chakras. And the first one we encounter is the Anahata chakra, which is the heart chakra at the center of the chest, which is all about compassion and love. The color associated with it is green, which is for a reason. Because what does a tree do? It takes in carbon dioxide and gives out oxygen. That's exactly what our heart does. And also the element associated with the heart is air, because it has a lot to do with breathing, even though we associate that more with the lungs. If we look at it deeper, it's where the quality of air changes from carbon dioxide to oxygen, and then it is supplied to the body. And from there, we move up to the Vishuddha chakra, which is all about expression and communication, which is where anger arises. And for many people who have issues with anger management, it is this chakra which needs to be looked at deeply. And from there, we move to the Ajna chakra, which is Ajna, meaning that it is like the master chakra, because it is also the place where the pituitary lies. It is also where the pineal gland lies. So the Ajna chakra has to do with intuition, and the color associated with the Ajna chakra is a deep blue, almost like a turquoise blue. And then we have the Sahasrara chakra, which is above the physical skull, as it were. And the color associated with is a violet or a white, depending on the tradition you follow. So this is just a very short introduction to the seven chakras. And the idea is that the Kundalini Shakti has to travel all the way from the Mooladhara to the Sahasrara. And there are three ways in which this Kundalini arising is possible. One is through sadhana, which means practice, any spiritual practice, whether it's mantra or meditation or any of the other yoga, anything that, you know, kind of works for you. The second way is when there is a spontaneous kind of awakening. It happens in some people. I like to believe that when you've done a lot of practice and sadhana in your previous life, that's when this happens. And the third way is when a very enlightened guru, a learned teacher, passes on this awakening just merely by a look or a touch. It's called Shaktipata. So these are the only three ways that I know of how the Kundalini can be awakened.
Thank you for taking us through that. With this Kundalini energy, how, in your experience, do you know if it is stuck somewhere? And yeah, so when the Kundalini has risen to the top of the head, that is when we're enlightened. Is that correct? And that is the quest. I'm also wondering, as you're explaining this, can the Kundalini energy drop back to different chakras as well?
It will drop back. Okay. The energy moving up to the Sahasrara is temporal. It's temporary. It's ephemeral. It's possibly just for a fraction of a second for most of us, unless you're an enlightened master. Perhaps then it could be a permanent state of being. But for most of us, because we're still in the practice, it's a very temporary state. And we have to keep practicing it, keep at it, in order for us to experience longer durations of this oneness of consciousness.
Mm.
So certainly, yes, it does drop back. But like I have said previously, it's easier to maintain it at the heart level.
Mm.
And call upon it whenever you want for, you know, to go into an alternate state of consciousness and awaken it from there into the Sahasrara, rather than to allow it to fall all the way to the Mooladhara and then bring it all the way up again.
Mm. I love that. Thank you for explaining.
And how do we know that there is a block?
Mm.
Your physical well-being and your mental well-being are very good indicators of where you're at with your chakras. So for people who have a lot of issues with digestion, for example, typically there is a problem or there is a blockage in the Manipura chakra. If you're having issues with sexuality, whether it's physical issues or whether it's just mental issues, then it lies in your Svadhisthana chakra. If you have problems associated with your parents or generally your connection with Mother Earth, then the Mooladhara chakra needs more grounding. It needs more energy there. And when we talk of the higher chakras, of course, the heart is all about love, not just for others. It starts with self-love. So in my experience as an intuitive healer and doing a lot of chakra work, I noticed that people, by and large, don't have so many problems in the lower chakras. The problems begin with the heart chakra because we have issues with forgiveness, we have problems with loving ourselves, and we all tend to live in the past, which tends to show up in the heart chakra. Mm-hmm. And in modern times, because communication has become like a non-stop endeavor, we are at it 24/7, there are a lot of problems with the Vishuddha chakra. The Anahata and the Vishuddha, these are the two where most people today are experiencing their problems.
Yes. Yes, so much there. I wanted to touch on what I've heard you previously say about the spiritual path, and when we engage in sadhana, spiritual practice, that this can expedite our karma. Could you go into a little bit of the nuances with that? Because I really resonate with that. I'd love to know more.
When I started my spiritual practice in 2003, my guru very clearly indicated to me that particularly around the time when you start your practice is when life is going to come at you in a way in which you never expected. And surely enough, within the next couple of months, there was immense upheaval in my life. And I like to understand it this way, that when you are ready and when you're at this point where you can evolve further is when you get into a spiritual practice. And that is the time when all the karmic load comes at you. Possibly what you would have taken about 10 or 12 years to live out and play out will come to you in a very concise and, like a very, very, how does one say it? A concrete kind of fashion. So it's like my guru always used to give the example of how when you're going in a slow moving car, every little detail on the street is visible. But when you're just whizzing past, everything becomes a blur. It's exactly like that on the spiritual path, because now suddenly your karma is coming at you very quickly, which means that there's going to be a lot of suffering. And that's the reason why in our tradition, it is so important to have a guru, because you need someone to take you through that path when the difficulties start to arise. And I know this to be true for everyone who started any kind of spiritual practice. There are always going to be impediments in the path, and the difficult moments are going to start to show up very quickly the moment you start your sadhana. And this was reiterated for me again when I got into my deep spiritual practice a couple of years ago, when my entire life just turned topsy-turvy. The moment I got on the path, yet again, it was a reiteration of the fact that it is never easy to be on the path. But you have to just plod through it, knowing that this is the test. This is the universe checking if you have it in you to move on and to move further down the path.
Yes. And in that hindsight, can you speak to what you're experiencing now from that initial moment of going through, I guess it's coined more as that dark night of the soul, that point. But it's very interesting what you say about the having that guru to really guide you. And how does that come about? How would you seek your guru? Do you think that the guru comes to you, you discover them when you're ready? What is the approach?
I believe truly that the guru comes to you when you're ready. And when you are about to begin your sadhana, he makes his presence felt, just like the divine consciousness makes its presence felt through the guru. And the guru doesn't need to be in your life forever. He can just come, do his job, and then move on and leave you to your own resources. But the hand-holding is required only when you're going through this really difficult patch. And I think every guru will guide you through that. And then once you've passed that, you are probably ready to move on to another person who will teach you something else. So the guru does not need to be just one person. For me, it's not been one person. Although we think of one person as the Paramaguru, who is the main guru. And then there are many people who teach you many things on the path. So I think the best guru is one who really wants you to be even better than him at whatever it is that we are practicing. But that is the one thing that I do not see in the gurus of today, or perhaps out of experience, I can say that most gurus today do not want the disciples to overtake them in terms of the spiritual practice or in terms of popularity or whatever it is. But I believe that a true guru is one who really lets you flourish, even if it means seeking out someone else on the path. And also, I want to say here that it is not necessary to have a guru, because the divine consciousness is also in you. If you believe in non-duality, then what is in the guru is also within you. So you just have to access the guru inside of you, your intuition, what your inner voice is telling you, and that can also serve as the guru. So for all of the people seeking a guru, it will happen. Your physical, you know, guru, if you want one, will make his or her presence felt. But until then, please tap into your own resources and keep your sadhana going.
Yes, I love that. And that has been my experience, that through that, that guru mentality of just unlocking a piece, like you have it already within you, but sometimes it is just that conversation, that piece of knowledge, that remembrance that allows you to unlock that next, I don't know how else to say it, next level of consciousness that was always there, but it's just like the key needed to be turned to unlock. That is how I've experienced it. But I think it's interesting what you bring up about more of that ego. And I feel that even in my journey, there has been that element of ego of, I can do this myself. And so I love your approach of, you know, yes, we have it inside, but there is also the avenue of seeking that initiation, I guess, in that level. I wanted to speak more about the 10 wisdom goddesses. And I've read this in your book and I found it really captivating. Could you explain how these 10 wisdom goddesses relate to the tantric practice? How do they fit? And you've also made me really curious about when you said that tantra was more of a rebellion. Am I correct in thinking that this is more of a feminine practice, or is it the feminine energy within tantra? I'm interested to know as well.
We'll have to go back a little bit to understand the history of tantra itself. Tantra originates from nature worship. And when you look at nature worship, the feminine aspect is considered to be truly sacred, because without the feminine, there is no creation itself. So tantra came out of that philosophy. And this is the reason why it is so important in the Hindu tradition itself looks at the divine feminine as being a very powerful element. Now, in tantra, we have all the devis. So we have to differentiate here between Shiva and Shakti. Shiva is pure consciousness, which is just lying dormant. Shiva can't do anything until this energy is infused into Shiva. So when Shiva and Shakti come together is when creation happens. So now Shakti is described as the divine feminine energy and is worshipped in the form of various goddesses, whether it's we can divide all or we can talk of all gods and goddesses in the Hindu pantheon as either being Ugra, which means their fear, or Amya, which means they're very benign and beautiful and full of grace. So some of the goddesses in the tantric tradition are not conforming to the traditional straight-laced version of how gods ought to be. And that is where we are talking of the Dashamahavidyas, which are the 10 wisdom goddesses, which stand for everything which was considered unholy or, you know, not sacred in Hinduism. And this has a lot to do with the culture and the entire system of castes and who is authorized to worship. And, you know, there's all these aspects which Tantra rebelled against, because at that time when Tantra was coming into popularity, women were not included in actual worship. It was exclusively by one caste. Only they were authorized to worship, and the others only had to stand at the periphery. And then Buddhism started to make inroads, because Buddhism was much more heterodox. It was much more all-encompassing. And Tantra made its presence felt at this time by bringing religion to everyone, making this knowledge of spiritual practice available to everyone, to the woman on the street, to the man who did not belong to a particular caste and who could then practice whatever spirituality he wanted. So Tantra in that sense was a rebellion. And it was a rebellion against the orthodox nature of worship which was practiced at that time. And in fact, if you look at the word Tantra, there scholars have pointed out that it is actually a slight pun, because up until then, everything was expressed as a sutra, which is an aphorism, which is, you know, like a short sentence. So you have sutra versus tantra. So sutra essentially means a thread, and tantra means something which is woven. So it was a way of saying, here you were hanging on a thread, but here you have this entire fabric that you can work on.
I love that.
So that's the beauty of it, that it's very inclusive, it's life affirming. It says you can go about living your family life, you don't have to renounce the world, and you can still aspire to spiritual evolution.
I love that. When it comes to this practice, what does this look like daily for you in your sadhana?
I would be a slightly deviant example because I spend a lot of time, I live like a hermit, I like to say. I have fulfilled all my obligations towards family. So to that extent, I can say safely that I'm rather selfish in the way that I'm living my life right now. So the way it is at the moment is about 4 or 5 hours of practice, which means meditation, chanting, and study as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like trying to gain the knowledge that is required, because in our tradition, there is only knowledge can help you find liberation. So that seeking of knowledge is very important. And that knowledge comes from reading, from, trying to understand your thoughts, trying to come to terms with everything that life has thrown at you. And then to accentuate it with meditation, to move away and to disassociate from everything that you have gone through. And then withdraw from all the senses and practice your mantras, your chanting, and all of that. So for me, it takes about 4 or 5 hours of the day. And also because I'm writing so extensively on the subject, sometimes it could even be 8 or 10 hours of the day, which goes in developing what I call as the, Devi consciousness. It's like how there is Krishna consciousness, where people live with Krishna on every breath. What I'm doing is focusing on the divine feminine as the consciousness that I want pervading my every breath. But for someone who's starting out, even a 10 or 15 minute practice is good. I would say it's a good start. But those 10 or 15 minutes have to be dedicated, they have to be concentrated, and they have to really bring to the table a sincerity and a devotion. That's the only mandate. Everything else, is variable. That's all right. But the time dedicated towards this has to be non-negotiable.
Yes, this makes me think about intention. And lately, I've been thinking a lot about manifestation. And I don't like using the word manifestation because of the connotation that it has. But I've been thinking about how we are very powerful and we can manifest, without using another word, but we can manifest what it is that we want. And usually this is typically the material possessions, or, a certain title, or, gaining something like that in this world. And lately I have been thinking, I love your thoughts on this around, yes, we can gain whatever we want in the material plane, but what does that cost us? What does that take from our life force energy? And it's made me think a lot more about the intention behind what it is that we're desiring or what we're wanting to achieve, thinking about what that intention is behind it, rather than I want this because of mainly attached to the ego. What are your thoughts about the intention and the manifestation of what we're wanting to call in our life?
I would say there is really nothing wrong with having material desires. In fact, I would say it's important to fulfill all our desires. So if we look at life in 4 quadrants, so there is one which is about our material comforts, about the work that we do, which is also very important and meaningful. And then there is the aspect of relationships. It could be any kind of relationship, whether it's a marital one, a parental one, with friends, with your colleagues, whatever. The third quadrant is health, physical, mental, spiritual health. And the fourth one would be self-actualization. And I think for every one of us, it's important to tick all these four boxes in order for us to actually feel that we are ready to move on and experience a different level of consciousness. If you do not fulfill all your material desires, you are always going to be wanting something. And that's not a good place to be. If you do not have a fulfilling relationship, again, you're going to feel a lacuna somewhere in your life, because born as a human being means that we are seeking a tribe, we are seeking society. It is embedded in our DNA to want to be a part of something larger than ourselves. And health is most important, because if you don't have good health, then you cannot aim to do any spiritual practice. And the last one is self-actualization, which can take the form that you desire. Whatever works for you. It could be yoga, it could be tai chi, it could be jujitsu, whatever works for you. But something that you do every day, which helps you to improve upon who you were yesterday, let's put it like that. Just to make you a slightly better human being each day. And I think it's important to never say no to enjoying all the things that life gives you. Not to feel guilty about it, not to feel that I don't deserve this, because if you've gotten it, it means that you have done something to earn it, either in this life or in a previous life. So the important thing is not to attach too much importance to any of these things and to start withdrawing.
I love that. And that brings me to something that you have said that I've written down, that I found really beautiful, and it did help ground me. I am nothing. I have nothing. I need nothing. And so yes. I was wondering if you could explain what that means to you in what you've just explained of allowing, but then not attaching.
For me, those three lines are the mantra by which I live my everyday life, because it becomes very easy to get carried away, especially when you're seeing a little bit of success, a lot of people reaching out to ask you things, and it can really go to your head. So I have to keep reminding myself that I am nothing. And the more I learn, the more I understand that there is much more to be learned, which is very, very humbling. And I think on the path, or even in life in general, it's very important to maintain a huge degree of humility. Because the moment we start allowing pride to come in is the moment our downfall begins. And I truly believe in this, and I want to embody this. I have nothing does not mean that I am not living in comfort or in luxury. It just means that I own many things, but I do not allow those things to own me. So I might have a fancy car, but I am not going to let the car overpower my thought process and have me think about not being in an accident, not damaging the car, not worrying about its maintenance. So I think it's more about not allowing the car to own my mind and live there rent-free. And I am nothing, I have nothing, and I need nothing, right? So it's essentially just to reaffirm that I am so grateful for what I have, that there is no space for anything else. You know, this is not a negative statement. It just means that I am so abundant at the moment that if this is all I ever have in life, I'm good with it. that I need nothing more. Even on the spiritual path, if I do not ever become enlightened, it's all right. I have this moment of bliss. I can go into this garden whenever I want. I can, you know, kind of go into that moment. I can become one with it. I can experience peace and bliss. And that's all I need. And if the universe feels that there is scope for me to further heighten my consciousness, it's welcome, but I don't need it. If it happens, that's perfectly fine. And I think what happens is with these three statements, your expectations from life comes to a zero. And then life just becomes so blissful, because when you don't expect something and something comes to you, it's a pleasant surprise. When you have expectations and you have people letting you down, you don't have the things that you want, that's when the suffering comes. So then, in a way, this is avoidance. This is, it's a positive way of avoiding all the pain and the suffering that you associate with wanting and desires and all of that.
Yes, I love that. I also wanted to ask, from a tantric perspective, especially for women, the aging process, how do you see that process, looking at it through an empowering lens? What is the benefit as we age? What is the philosophy there that you embody?
I would like to draw an example from the Dashamahavidyas. There is a goddess there who is called Dhumavati. So she is a widow who is seen looking very old and haggard because she's lost her looks. And in Indian culture, the widow is considered inauspicious and she's not invited to, you know, auspicious ceremonies. And she's essentially one who lives on the periphery of society itself, almost to the point of ostracization. And the Dashamahavidyas have a very beautiful way of offering something positive in return. When you're ostracized by society, when nobody wants you anymore, and you've lost your beauty and your charm and all of that, spirituality is there to come and claim you. And you then lose yourself, because spirituality is not looking at you, whether you have a beautiful face or whether you have this beautiful body or whether you're auspicious or inauspicious, it's all embracing. So I would like to believe that that is what Tantra teaches us about aging. And I'm 55 and it has not been an easy process, particularly the past couple of years when you see, you know, everything going downhill. And I have been grappling with it. And I think it's tremendously difficult, particularly when you're in the public eye and when people judge you so much by the way you look or by the shape of your body and all of that. But I think for me, the respite has been my practice, because it teaches me that this body is just a very, very temporary phenomenon and we should not ascribe too much importance to it. In fact, not too much. In fact, we should ascribe no importance to it. It's just a bag. It's like a container of everything that's important. So value it, treat it like it is a temple, but don't ascribe too much importance to it.
Do you think that the aging process, especially for women, with how it is portrayed in society, is that invitation, like you said, for that spiritual development, to go deeper into that, to as an initiation, as we get older, to go deeper onto the path?
I would like to believe that is what nature intended. As we age and as we focus less on the looks and in trying to keep up with whatever it is that we are doing in life, the process becomes more inward. And then you have the life experience also to understand why you're here and what is it that has brought you to this point and what is it that you want to learn from your own life. Because, see, we are here because we have chosen to be here. And every single thing that has happened to us is out of our own volition. Much as we would like to believe that we didn't choose this and life happened to us, it's not true. It's because we have chosen this as our life path. And that's why we are at this point in life today. And if we are meant to be on the spiritual path, then I think it helps to not focus so much on even the mental aspect, not just the physical beauty, but even mentally, as I think I don't have as much memory power as I had in my early 30s or 40s. But I think in a way it's good because you tend to forget more things and that makes you live more in the present moment. And that's the spin I put on everything these days. There's something positive to take away from every single development.
Yes, I love that, Lens. I just wanted to ask as well, do you, and how does it, I don't know if this fits in, Vedic astrology, do you prescribe to astrology? And is there any Tantra overlay, or does it weave into Tantra in any way?
I do believe in Jyotishya. That is the Vedic astrology. And it is very much a part of Tantra, because if you observe the texts of where Tantra comes from, they're called the Agamas. And the Agamas describe cosmology, astronomy, astrology, all of this in great detail. So Tantra and Jyotishya are very closely and inextricably linked. So I do believe very closely in Jyotishya, and everything that I do, I see the pattern. I know my numbers. I know what numbers are in sync with my present birth. And I always consult the Jyotishya before I do anything in my life. Because for me, it's not different from my path. It's a part of the tantric way of life.
I love that, because I noticed your beautiful, is it the blue sapphire on your hand? Yeah.
Because I'm very much driven by Saturn.
Yes.
W8. And everything that happens, to just give you one example, there was a podcast which I appeared on, and they hadn't played it for a long period of time. And then one day they called me out of the blue and they said, we are airing it today. And I was very surprised, because it was not a number which I am used to. Things happened to me on a number 8 day. So they called me on the 25th, and I was quite sure that for some reason this will not happen. And sure enough, I get a call saying there was an audio glitch. We couldn't upload it. We are uploading it the next day, which was the 26th. And the episode number ended in an 8. So for me, you know, it was an indication that, okay, the universe is looking after me. So, and I see this every single day. You know, the people I'm closest to are all number 8s. And I connect better with them. I have an affinity towards them. And so there is this, you have to watch the patterns. You have to see the serendipity. You have to understand the synchronicity. And that only you can do for yourself. You might, you know, have some outer help from outside, like a qualified Jyotishya. But I think it helps when you have that inner knowledge by yourself.
I love that. And that makes even more sense because I'm in my Saturn Dasha. So obviously Saturn has brought us together today.
Right. I would believe that. Absolutely.
Before we go, I would love to know how my audience can connect with you and also what projects you have at the moment. I know that you're writing your 6th book. If you could give a preview to that as well.
One of the seminal texts of the Sri Vidya tradition is a stotra, which is like a long 1,000-word mantra called the Lalita Sahasranama. It's a very beautiful piece of poetry, and it has a lot of esoteric hidden meanings. I'm working on that at the moment. The book should be out before Navratri. Apart from that, I have a non-profit organization by the name of Sri Chakra Yantra Foundation, and we're working on 3 projects currently in South India. One is for farmers' welfare. We have actually adopted a village where they used to grow tobacco, which was not good for either the environment or the farmers. And we've enticed them to move to another cash crop, for which we are helping them with the implements and sprinklers. The second project I'm very passionate about is helping women who need legal aid. So we are supporting them. And the third project is animal welfare, because a lot of animals are abandoned and they need a home and they need shelter and food. So these are the 3 projects that I'm currently working with the team to fulfill. And how people can reach me, I have one-on-one sessions available, meet.vinitarashinkar.in. And these are paid sessions, but the money, 100% of the proceeds go towards the charities that I just spoke about through the Sri Chakra Yantra Foundation. So in these one-on-one sessions, people can speak to me about their spiritual path, about Sri Vidya, about energy, whatever it is that is bothering them at that point of time. And I'm on Instagram at Vinita_Rashinkar. And my website is vinitarashinkar.in.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this conversation and taking the time. And I would love to ask you to do the closing prayer for the abundance and blessing as well.
So this prayer comes from the Rig Veda, which is the oldest scripture. And it's a prayer it's actually a blessing of abundance in all aspects of living. So here we go. Om Shri Varchasvamayushyamaro Gyamavidha Chobhamanam Mahiyate Dhanyam Dhanam Pashum Bahuputra Labham Shatasam Vatsaram Dirghamayuhu Shri Matre Namaha.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having had me on the show. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And I look forward to more such interesting conversations. Thank you, Tara.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning into Star Being. May the wisdom shared resonate in your soul. Until next time, stay connected and keep reaching for the stars. This is Star Being signing off.